Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming. Welcome to the University of Minnesota Bookstores. Before we begin, I would like to invite you to visit our website, where you can find a listing of upcoming author events and where you can also access podcasts of the events that we've had in the past. It takes about a week for them to get to be available online. Our guest today is Tim Nolan. He was born in Minneapolis in 1954 and graduated from the University of Minnesota in 78 with a bachelor's degree in English. He and his wife Kate moved to New York City in 78, and he earned a fine arts degree, a master's in fine arts in writing from Columbia University. He then worked as an archivist at the Whitney Museum and read the poetry slush pile for the Paris Review. He returned to Minnesota in 1985 and then received his law degree from William Mitchell College of Law in 89. He is an attorney with the McGran Shea Law Firm in Minneapolis, where he practices in litigation, including real estate, eminent domain, and construction. He lives in South Minneapolis with Kate and their three teenagers, Elizabeth, Maeve, and Frank. He's here today with us to celebrate the publication of his newest book of poems, his first book of poems.
My only book of poems.
So he'll do a reading for us, and then he'll take your questions and sign books. Please join me in welcoming Tim Nolan.
Well, thanks a lot for coming out. I was at Gustavus last night for a reading, and they have their newspaper with an article about me, and the little caption under here says, Nolan is one of the few people who has successfully made his living off poetry and is publishing his first book, which I thought was just great. I mean, something was lost in the translation for this reporter for the Gustavian or whatever the newspaper is, but I haven't made my living off of poetry. I think I made about $572 or so off of poetry, but I did have recently, I wrote a poem. I mean, this is never going to happen again, but I wrote a poem on a Sunday night. Maybe I'll read it later, and I rewrote it a little bit on a Monday morning, and then I sent it to the Writer's Almanac, and I got it accepted on Tuesday afternoon, and I got $100 for that. So that's almost $100 an hour or something, which is not as much as my hourly billable rate as a lawyer, but... Well, let me... I'm not going to read very many poems. I'll just read maybe a handful, and then we can maybe talk, or you can ask questions. I'll start out with the first poem in the book is kind of an intro poem. It's called "Waiting for the Song." No matter what corner of the world, we wait for that song at dusk. The one that will tell us how the sun goes down, how it eases into the ocean, or slips behind the mountain, or silhouettes the singer on that balcony above. The one who wails in that strange voice to Allah, or to our own operatic Yahweh, or to the Buddha. Then the song seems smooth as those stones that rattle and tumble underwater with fluid clicking like tapping on the skull. And what about New Orleans, where the song comes with the slow clarinet of Sidney Bechet and seems to suggest the strong possibility of getting lucky later? This same old song travels the world, the going down to dusk song, carried by our original vocalists, the Birds. They cannot stop themselves from singing every chance, every loss, every dusk. I can't see the page through this microphone. How can I do this? Can I stand here and you can hear? Okay. I have to look around the audience to make sure. I have an eccentric uncle who was an Irish uncle who never married and stayed at home. And has his many charms, but also kind of many frustrations. So this is partly about him. Chekhovian childhood. My childhood was Chekhovian because the adults all had a funny dignity about them, but despair was as near as the front door, or the breath taken in but never released. And they all had deep souls and plans that could not be shared except in total silence. Then we would all pause to wait for that creak of the front door and what would happen next. When I saw Uncle Vanya as a boy, I thought, how does he know all about us? As if he had to be there when my Uncle Gene and my dad, as adults, tumbled around on Grandma's lawn, an old fight, who would rake the leaves. Someone said the word paranoid. Someone felt a long betrayal. My ancient and gentle Uncle Walter broke them up like a sensible peasant shuffling over from next door. I knew things could happen like this, and if you place the rifle above the mantle, you can expect it will go off. But since this is comedy, the bullet must always go astray. That actually happened. I mean, my dad and my uncle were probably in their 50s when this happened, and it was a Sunday morning and everybody was coming home from church. That was what horrified my grandmother, that somebody would see them. I'm not used to this book yet, so I don't know where things are. Almost 50. Well, no, that's not true anymore. I'm over 50, so, well, this was a few years ago. Almost 50. These years don't mean as much as we think. They are merely markers for memories, milestones, or millstones, and the effect of the birthday is always the same. Here I go, or I must be in the deep end of the pool. Now some things slow, then everything speeds up. I would be dead if I were this age in Connemara, 1848, or if not dead, ancient and gray with 12 kids. I would scrape the dry hillside. Still, this is a broad plain, P-L-A-I-N, looking across. There's no one else here. It makes me understand I could become strange to myself, being both the passenger and my own luggage on a trip that's been going on so long I can remember again just how it turns out. I read something a little, kind of blow the pipes out or something, a little longer. This is called Totally Random. I realized when I was at Gustavus last night, I started talking about this phrase, totally random, and then, of course, there are all these students in the audience who are like a year older than my oldest daughter, so of course they would understand totally random. But then I heard this word, sketchy, like this kind of a sketchy restaurant or this kind of a sketchy gas station or that guy's kind of a sketchy guy. I like that. I mean, do you all use that? Sketchy this, sketchy that. So I have to write a poem called Sketchy, but this is totally random. This was a few years ago. So at last it's summer, and I'm driving my teenage daughter and her friend to the latest blockbuster movie at the Megastar Cinema, and we're chatting in the car about the latest blockbuster movie we each saw in the last week, and Lizzie says, it was like a monster movie with the weather as the monster, and Lizzie and Mary now dissect the movie in a way that belongs to 14-year-old girls and is very pleasing to me because they see below the surface of this big culture, and I'm thinking, maybe we are raising healthy skeptics, even if they are goofy and loud and easily amused and shyly knowing. And now they are observing how totally random it was in the Monster Weather movie when the wolves showed up on the Russian freighter that had eased down Fifth Avenue, scraped its hull, and came to rest on the steps of the New York Public Library. How random that the wolves were so aggressive when they would probably just cower in the cold and turn in on themselves doggishly. And could books, even the Gutenberg Bible, burn at all if it was 170 degrees below zero? And random totally how the girl had to slice open her leg on the bumper of the taxi cab just so the boy could search the Russian freighter for those Russian medical supplies. And I said they wanted to work in a love story too, and the girls both go, but that's so random. And what about the randomness of divorce in the movies and everywhere? Everyone's divorced and happily divorced and even in love still, but divorced. And the ex-husband and ex-wife are both beautiful and understanding parents with beautiful and wise children who help them find a way to themselves. And I'm thinking, these girls here in the car are so smart and alive that I would walk from Philadelphia to New York City in my snowshoes and special Arctic gear to save them. But at the same time, I'm thinking, how totally random being in this car, rushing down Xerxes Avenue so the kids won't miss the previews, and random the previews, and random the president and the Congress, random the transit of Venus, completely random the beginning of this endless summer of being 14 years old, and inevitably random watching the boys slouching into the Megastar Cinema, their baggy pants and rangy wolf-like prowl, and random my watching, random as in a random bystander. All of this makes my promise to return later seem full with intent. I read this kind of a prose, little prose poem, but it's part of a section of the book, the second section of the book, that is really one poem that I wrote like 25 years ago. And I was in a class with Robert Haas teaching the class, and he had been translating Czeslaw Milosz's poems and was very interested in long poems in different sections and in different manners, like poems that were more metrical and maybe poems with a short line and then followed by prose and followed. And so what he said, which was perfect instruction, was, here's what you're going to do. You're going to write a long poem this week when I'm working with you. And we're going to start out, you're going to write a poem in the style of your favorite poet. That'll be the first section. And then the second section will be some prose in the style of your favorite prose writer. Then you should do two little short poems that are kind of companion poems to one another and that are the same length. And so it was kind of a revelation to me, and I wrote this poem that then some years later I sent it to Plowshares, and Rita Dove was editing Plowshares for that issue, and she took the whole thing. I said, here's this poem. Take any part of it you want. She took the whole thing. Well, this is I realized when I put this book together that there were parts of it that I didn't like very much. So they're not all here, but let me read you this prose thing, what called Bridge, which was in the style of James Joyce. I don't know if it is now, but that was my intention. Downstairs, they are playing bridge. For this game, they need card tables, although he can't understand why. He imagines the men on one side of the room and the women on the other side. The women have kicked off their shoes and wade in the wool carpet like little girls. The men take the game seriously and keep their shoes on. Now they face each other, husbands and wives, and they all seem to swallow the silence that floats above the room. When his family drove in the country and came upon those metal suspension bridges that looked like jungle gyms, he always thought the car would go up and over the silver hump. Bridges and roller coasters resembled one another in the way Bob Hope resembled Hubert Humphrey. And so their functions must be nearly the same. Because he closed his eyes and held his breath when they approached one of those bridges, he always figured the car had been safely delivered up and over the bridge, across the Rum River or the Red River or the St. Croix. And so the game of bridge downstairs. The men and women raise their arms above their heads and lean toward one another until their hands touch. Then one of the smaller women walks slowly up the back of one of the husbands, up and over, and slowly down the back of one of the wives. Then they change partners to see if they are married to the right person, the person who will be able to support them. This is bridge, and it goes on all night, punctuated by good-hearted laughter, up and over, or falling, sometimes falling into the water like two fish. I sometimes, I write a lot sitting in a lawn chair in the front yard because I smoke, so I can smoke in the front yard. And I write pretty quickly, and I don't edit myself very much, at least at the first draft of a poem. And I like Frank O'Hara. Frank O'Hara, you know, great poet, died young, was a curator at the Museum of Modern Art. And he would go out at lunch, and he would write poems at lunch. He collected them, he called them lunch poems. But his poems tended to be, you know, then this happened, and this happened, and this happened. And so I kind of think of them as like piling on poems, where you pile on the images and details, whatever is there that's available if you're sitting in your front yard or in your living room. So this is called Full Stride. I'm watching Antiques Roadshow, where they're looking at a clock by Samuel Mulliken that is worth $75,000, while our oldest daughter is roaring through Rhapsody in Blue on the out-of-tune piano. The F-sharp is dead. And now they're looking at a print of a locomotive, the Taunton locomotive, that is worth $3,800, not to me. And now I'm thinking I should change the channel to see what's happening with the war, but I already know, having just read the newspaper. And now they're examining a porcelain Rembrandt knockoff of an incredibly ugly woman, and they say it's only worth $1,500, but the frame is worth much more without the ugly woman. And it's Christmas almost. The tree beside me, dark and fragrant, not lit yet. For a moment, I'm in the deep forest, piled high with snow. And now our nephew Matt comes over for dinner. He's going to Iraq next month. We got him some wool socks, an Orlon t-shirt, and special goggles that will protect his eyes from shrapnel. Can't believe I've written this. It seems we should make something of our weariness, some full breath and quiet out of all the noise. Matt tries on the goggles and socks. He looks like a yellow-eyed alien dressed up for Christmas. He looks like his grandpa looked, straight at the camera, in full stride. Maybe I'll just read a few more, and then if you have any questions, or if you want to, this kind of seems like a one-sided conversation so far. Oh, Kirsten Durkin is here. I want to read this one for you because your name is in it. Or a confused, it's not really for you, but this is called The Big Curve. I can still do the crossword puzzle, at least until Wednesday. But on Thursday, I can't remember a word or spell anything. I can still run when required, but I place myself in fewer situations where running is required. If I skin my knee now, the rest of my leg might fall off. And while I've never broken a bone, if I did, I might give up the wrist or the thumb. I would accommodate the bum ankle. I forget everything, all the time. The name of Gary Cooper's wife, why should I know that anyway? Or Hamlet's friend from college, or even where Hamlet went to college. I try to remember the new employee's name, but it always seems to be Alyssa or Jessica or Kristen, not Kirsten. Why do I need to remember this anyway? It makes me sad to be failing all these tests. Then at once I remember how the bright snow billowed up and banked the sidewalk on the way to school. It was different then, how we walked everywhere or ran. And when we rode in a car, it was still a luxury. It was a magic carpet, the way the capacious Chevy floated on a cushion of air. So when we came to the big curve in the rocky road, her name was Rocky, we would lean into each other, holding that welted cord, leaning into the big curve, not feeling any bumps along the way, as if it would never end. Kristen, not Kirsten. Or Kirsten, not Kristen. Well, let me read. I'll just read one more, and then if you want to talk, we can talk. This is called Based on a True Story. Once we taped up all the corners in our little apartment and sprayed insecticide everywhere, and we thought we got rid of all the cockroaches. But how could we think that, since cockroaches have been around for about 250 million years? And in our little kitchen, the little radio was warm and tuned to WNYC, and the light glowed, and the music of Mozart made us happy. Then we saw that cockroach riding on the yellow dial down to where the slow dirge came from New Orleans, to where Phil Rizzuto said, "Can you believe that?" when the first baseman couldn't lay down the bunt. And we opened the back of the radio and they swarmed out. They had eaten the glue behind the knobs. And we screamed, "Oh my God," we were so disgusted with all the life of it, the incessant life of it all. I don't think we're over it yet. I'll read one more. I have to tell this little story. Our son Frank he's 15, or he's going to be 15 next month. But he's been a big baseball player. He loves baseball, and he knows everything about baseball. So maybe 4 or 5 years, he's probably about 10 or 11. For Christmas, we got him a Derek Jeter pitching machine, battery-operated, plastic balls, you know, for Christmas. And so we're opening it up and getting the batteries out, and he stops and he just says, "Dad, since when did they name," I'm looking at you because you'll get this, "since when did they name a battery for Al Kaline?" Okay, I mean, it's really funny, but if you don't know who Al Kaline is, it's not as funny, but famous Detroit Tigers 1950s player. Anyway, so Frank knows everything about baseball. This is called Signal from the Stands. He's a much better athlete than I ever was. The way he rises on the balls of his feet before each pitch and is ready and focused to move. And the way when the action stops, he conserves his strength, doesn't waste a moment, covering first base with that mitt the size of Rhode Island. His slender and beautiful legs, the crisp white pants, the way he crowds the plate and is not afraid of the big, dumb pitcher from Blaine. Then, when he has the time to wait, the time in the endless summer to wait, he might look toward the stands, toward me, and I give him our own signal, that thumbs up, which he acknowledges across the years, just for me, this serious nod from his blue cap. So, I think that's all I'll read, but I'd love to talk to you if you have any questions or, and I'm going to sign books too. Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you balance time to write when your lawyer in the law can get sort of not inspirational? And
Sort of not inspirational.
Sometimes I got inspired, but I just find that it's so draining because you're writing and you're reading things that you don't want to be writing and reading. And then I come home and I want to write.
Yeah, I remember that. Oh, especially when you're a student, it does get better, yeah. I remember when I think the first week that I was a law student, I had, you know, my first contracts book with the cases in it, and I had like 10 different colored magic markers to do 10 different things. Total waste of time. You know, and I was underlining and highlighting everything. As if this was a science. I mean, forget it, you know, because they try to suggest at law school that there's something scientific about this study. There isn't. I mean, it's just like any other study. So, I mean, what year are you? Oh, okay, so you're way past this. You've got it to the point where it's a game. It's just a game. But maybe you just got to be patient, because once you get through law school, you have more time. I mean, you'll be working, but you'll have more time for yourself and reading. But it's hard to read. We have to read so much in law school. It's hard to read.
Do you have a set schedule? Or do you have like time that you block out for yourself that you write, or do you just
all the time? I don't really have a set schedule, and I don't necessarily write every day, but I write pretty quickly, or I've learned to write quickly, so I don't, so it doesn't take me very long to get a first draft. You know, it might not be very good. I was at a thing you were at the book festival on Saturday. There was this seminar or a panel discussion on juggling life and literature, which it was kind of funny. I didn't attend the whole thing, but I realized I was kind of annoyed with the topic, because I don't think you juggle. I mean, if I'm juggling anything, it's like life. I mean, the literature I'm not juggling. I mean, but the life I may be, you know, keeping plates up in the air and stuff. But the notion that you need to have big spaces of time to accomplish anything. I think you need little spaces of time to get, you know, to get things done. See, I wouldn't be good at like a artist colony. Yeah. You know, if somebody was coming and delivering a lunch to me and stuff, and I had this endless time, I would like, I'd have to go into the town and go to the hardware store. I'd look at the wall. But if give me 5 minutes, if that's all I have, kind of like we don't have much time. So, I mean, if you want to write, you find a time to write. We don't have much time in a big sense, which is kind of the big subject of most poetry, is we don't have much time. I wish we had more time. We hardly have any time, and we lose everything. And we all die. So I got kind of annoyed at this, too privately annoyed at this little panel discussion, because I thought there was an element of whining about how do you keep track of, you know, your writing and your life and your children, and just take a deep breath. Yes. Well, I mean, this is the first one I published, but I've written, I don't know, I mean, I probably have 10 different versions, not of this, but of the last 15 years or so, that I have so many poems that I've forgotten I wrote. When I was down in St. Peter last night, Joyce Sutphen, who was a wonderful poet, introduced me, and I send her a lot. I mean, I basically send her everything I write, which I know must be like totally annoying to her at times. But so she starts out her little introduction reading clips from my emails to her. Dear Joyce, you know, here's something I don't like very much. Dear Joyce, here's something about the rain. Dear Joyce, she read like 10 of them. I just thought, God, what a odd, persistent person this was. But Joyce reads my stuff, and she hardly says anything except, oh, I like that, you know. And my wife reads my stuff, and she just likes everything, so she's not a very good, or she says she likes everything, but she's not a very good editor. But you do need to have people who are on to you. I mean, it's really good to have people who kind of get you, get what you're trying to do, kind of see when you don't do it. Anything, any other?
How long do the poems go back in this book? I mean, how many years worth of writing?
Well, that little bridge poem I read is about 25 years old, I guess. And there's a poem in here. It was the first poem I ever had published, and it was published in The Nation magazine, which was kind of a big deal. I got paid $50 for it. So that's about 25 years ago, something like that. And then a lot, I would say half of it is from the last 3 or 4 years, maybe more than half of it. Mimi.
Say something about how the shape of this particular book came together?
Yeah, I should, in response to your question, I should also have mentioned Jim Moore, who's, you know, a wonderful local poet, looked at about 5 or 6 of my manuscripts, and he did it really quickly. And if he liked a poem, he would say something about it right within the document itself. And if he didn't like a poem or didn't have anything to say about it, he would just skip it. And so those poems that he skipped, I let go. Some of them I liked quite a bit too, you know, so I was a little disappointed when he didn't like them. But he would say things, if he would say anything about a poem he didn't like, he would say, "You've done this elsewhere better." You know, which is hard for a writer. I mean, you work with what you've got, but you also kind of mine the same material over and over again. You don't always know it. You kind of do the same trick. You pull the same gimmicks and stuff, and you don't always know that you're doing that. So he was a big help in terms of, was that part of what you were thinking of, Mimi? In shaping it and... Yeah.
I mean, it's like he gave you a sense of what might pull together as a book as opposed to you've got all this material
right.
And can't figure out how to make it fit once.
Right. I struggle with that because I don't know. It's a whole different talent. You can sit down and write individual poems and work on them and shape them and stuff. And then you're thinking, how do I present this in a book so that it will be read with some continuity or purpose? Then, of course, I don't read books of poetry from beginning to end. So I'm not the best, you know, I mean, I don't sit down and, oh, here we go, okay, and read the whole thing from, I always just flip around. Well, the first thing I do is, like, where'd they get these poems published? That's what I want to see. You know, and where do they go to school and who are they and stuff? Like in a literary magazine, I always look at the back pages first. Then I kind of regretfully go look at some of the poems. But I don't do it I don't know if like only if judges for contests read books from beginning to end, but it seems to me, I feel like I'm at a disadvantage. I don't know if it's a disadvantage, but I don't write narrative. I don't write poems that fall into a narrative sequence. And there have been lots of books published fairly recently that have a narrative theme. You know, they may be about somebody else entirely, somebody other than the poet, you know. And they're about some bigger narrative, but that I don't think that way. So I think of individual poems, and then you have to kind of see how they fit together if they do. Well, thank you very much. We got books up here. I'd be happy to sign books. Thanks for coming out.